Audio Renaissance presents Hegemony or Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance, by Noam Chomsky. Read for you by Brian Jones, with an introduction by the author. This is Noam Chomsky speaking to you from my office at MIT and doing something I've never done before after having written 50 or I don't know how many books, namely talking about it. So I'm talking about the book which is entitled Hegemony or Survival. What I mean by that is pretty straightforward. Survival is a word we all understand. I'd like to know whether there's going to be a world, a decent world in which, say, my grandchildren can live. That's the question of survival. The survival of the human species is by no means an obvious thing. There are very severe threats to survival. We learn about them all the time. The threat of environmental destruction is much too real to put to the side. The threat of destruction by weapons of mass destruction, that has come very close many times. We just learned that at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis, a probably terminal nuclear war was averted by one word from one submarine commander who countermanded an order to send off nuclear missiles. Major threats are predicted, in large part as a consequence of government policies. Hart Rudman High-Level Task Force can give you a list of them that just came out. So the survival of the species is by no means a sure thing, decent survival. Well, what's hegemony? A hegemony has to do with a domination of the international system by small sectors of power at the moment. That happens to be one superpower, which does not dominate the rest of the world in all dimensions, but overwhelmingly dominates it in one dimension, namely the military dimension. The United States now probably outspends the next maybe 25 countries in the world in military expenditures and is increasing that lead, and furthermore has made it extremely clear and unambiguous that it intends to make sure that it will dominate the world by force, the dimension in which it reigns supreme, and that it will tolerate no competitors. This has caused plenty of shudders in the world, even in the U.S. foreign policy elite. And though it's not unique to this administration or even to the United States, it is taking a historical form which is unusual, maybe unprecedented. Well, then, what are the consequences of hegemony for survival? Unfortunately, if you look at the factors that surround hegemony, the short-term goals to maximize profit, to increase control of the world, and so on. You ask how those goals play out. Turns out they do happen to threaten survival. And it's a deep problem because the decisions are not irrational within the framework of the institutions in which they're being taken, but they may be utterly irrational as compared with the likelihood that my grandchildren will have a world to live in. So, for example, in the military dimension, carrying forth the announced goal of controlling the world by force and ensuring that there are no competitors is almost certainly leading to proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, increasing of tension, increasing of the likelihood of terrorist operations, which could be quite serious. And those can, in unanticipated ways, lead to massive destruction. Just to turn to another dimension, the United States is alone in the world. And this is not Bush, this goes back to the Clinton administration and before, is alone in the world in trying to move to the militarization of space. Those policies are intended, as is stated, to ensure U.S. commercial interests and investments. However, if you look at those plans, they pose an extreme threat to survival because of the nature of the systems that are being considered. And across the board, the choice between hegemony and survival is one that we must face if we care about our grandchildren.
Chapter 1, Priorities and Prospects. A few years ago, one of the great figures of contemporary biology, Ernst Mayr, published some reflections on the likelihood of success in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. He considered the prospects very low. His reasoning had to do with the adaptive value of what we call higher intelligence, meaning the particular human form of intellectual organization. Meyer estimated the number of species since the origin of life at about 50 billion, only one of which achieved the kind of intelligence needed to establish a civilization. It did so very recently, perhaps 100,000 years ago. It is generally assumed that only one small breeding group survived, of which we are all descendants. Meyer speculated that the human form of intellectual organization may not be favored by selection. The history of life on Earth, he wrote, refutes the claim that it is better to be smart than to be stupid, at least judging by biological success. Beetles and bacteria, for example, are vastly more successful than humans in terms of survival. He also made the rather somber observation that the average life expectancy of a species is about 100,000 years. We are entering a period of human history that may provide an answer to the question of whether it is better to be smart than stupid. The most hopeful prospect is that the question will not be answered. If it receives a definite answer, that answer can only be that humans were a kind of biological error, using their allotted 100,000 years to destroy themselves and, in the process, much else. The species has surely developed the capacity to do just that, and a hypothetical extraterrestrial observer might well conclude that humans have demonstrated that capacity throughout their history, dramatically in the past few hundred years, with an assault on the environment that sustains life, on the diversity of more complex organisms, and with cold and calculated savagery on each other as well. Two superpowers. The year 2003 opened with many indications that concerns about human survival are all too realistic. To mention just a few examples, in the early fall of 2002, it was learned that a possibly terminal nuclear war was barely avoided 40 years earlier. Immediately after this startling discovery, the Bush administration blocked UN efforts to ban the militarization of space, a serious threat to survival. The administration also terminated international negotiations to prevent biological warfare and moved to ensure the inevitability of an attack on Iraq, despite popular opposition that was without historical precedent. Aid organizations with extensive experience in Iraq and studies by respected medical organizations warned that the planned invasion might precipitate a humanitarian catastrophe. The warnings were ignored by Washington and evoked little media interest. A high-level U.S. task force concluded that attacks with weapons of mass destruction, WMD, within the United States are likely and would become more so in the event of war with Iraq. Numerous specialists and intelligence agencies issued similar warnings, adding that Washington's belligerence, not only with regard to Iraq, was increasing the long-term threat of international terrorism and proliferation of WMD. These warnings, too, were dismissed. In September 2002, the Bush administration announced its national security strategy, which declared the right to resort to force to eliminate any perceived challenge to U.S. global hegemony, which is to be permanent. The new grand strategy aroused deep concern worldwide, even within the foreign policy elite at home. Also in September, a propaganda campaign was launched to depict Saddam Hussein as an imminent threat to the United States and to insinuate that he was responsible for the 9/11 atrocities and was planning others. The campaign, timed to the onset of the midterm congressional elections, was highly successful in shifting attitudes. It soon drove American public opinion off the global spectrum and helped the administration achieve electoral aims and establish Iraq as a proper test case for the newly announced doctrine of resort to force at will. President Bush and his associates also persisted in undermining international efforts to reduce threats to the environment that are recognized to be severe, with pretexts that barely concealed their devotion to narrow sectors of private power. The administration's Climate Change Science Plan, CCSP, wrote Science magazine editor Donald Kennedy, is a travesty that included no recommendations for emission limitation or other forms of mitigation, contenting itself with voluntary reduction targets, which, even if met, would allow U.S. emission rates to continue to grow at around 14% per decade. The CCSP did not even consider the likelihood, suggested by a growing body of evidence, that the short-term warming changes it ignores will trigger an abrupt, non-linear process, producing dramatic temperature changes that could carry extreme risks for the United States, Europe, and other temperate zones. The Bush administration's contemptuous pass on multilateral engagement with the global warming problem, Kennedy continued, is the stance that began the long continuing process of eroding its friendships in Europe, leading to smoldering resentment. By October 2002, it was becoming hard to ignore the fact that the world was more concerned about the unbridled use of American power than about the threat posed by Saddam Hussein, and as intent on limiting the giant's power as in taking away the despot's weapons. World concerns mounted in the months that followed, as the giant made clear its intent to attack Iraq, even if the UN inspections it reluctantly tolerated failed to unearth weapons that would provide a pretext. By December, support for Washington's war plan scarcely reached 10% almost anywhere outside the U.S., according to international polls. 2 months later, after enormous worldwide protests, the press reported that there may still be two superpowers on the planet, the United States and world public opinion. The United States here meaning state power, not the public or even elite opinion. By early 2003, studies revealed that fear of the United States had reached remarkable heights throughout the world, along with distrust of the political leadership. Dismissal of elementary human rights and needs was matched by a display of contempt for democracy for which no parallel comes easily to mind, accompanied by professions of sincere dedication to human rights and democracy. The unfolding events should be deeply disturbing to those who have concerns about the world they are leaving to their grandchildren. Though Bush planners are at an extreme end of the traditional U.S. policy spectrum, their programs and doctrines have many precursors, both in U.S. history and among earlier aspirants to global power. More ominously, their decisions may not be irrational within the framework of prevailing ideology and the institutions that embody it. There is ample historical precedent for the willingness of leaders to threaten or resort to violence in the face of significant risk of catastrophe. But the stakes are far higher today. The choice between hegemony and survival has rarely, if ever, been so starkly posed. Let us try to unravel some of the many strands that enter into this complex tapestry, focusing attention on the world power that proclaims global hegemony. Its actions and guiding doctrines must be a primary concern for everyone on the planet, particularly, of course, for Americans. Many enjoy unusual advantages and freedom, hence the ability to shape the future, and should face with care the responsibilities that are the immediate corollary of such privilege. Enemy territory. Those who want to face their responsibilities with a genuine commitment to democracy and freedom, even to decent survival, should recognize the barriers that stand in the way. In violent states, these are not concealed. In more democratic societies, barriers are more subtle. While methods differ sharply from more brutal to more free societies, the goals are in many ways similar: to ensure that the great beast, as Alexander Hamilton called the people, does not stray from its proper confines. Controlling the general population has always been a dominant concern of power and privilege, particularly since the first modern democratic revolution in 17th century England. The self-described men of best quality were appalled as a giddy multitude of beasts in men's shapes rejected the basic framework of the civil conflict raging in England between king and parliament, and called for government by countrymen like ourselves that know our wants, not by knights and gentlemen that make us laws that are chosen for fear and do but oppress us, and do not know the people's sores. The men of best quality recognize that if the people are so depraved and corrupt as to confer places of power and trust upon wicked and undeserving men, they forfeit their power in this behalf unto those that are good, though but a few. Almost three centuries later, Wilsonian idealism, as it is standardly termed, adopted a rather similar stance. Abroad, it is Washington's responsibility to ensure that government is in the hands of the good, though but a few. At home, it is necessary to safeguard a system of elite decision-making and public ratification, polyarchy, in the terminology of political science, not democracy. As president, Woodrow Wilson himself did not shrink from severely repressive policies even within the United States, but such measures are not normally available in places where popular struggles have won a substantial measure of freedom and rights. By Wilson's day, it was widely recognized by elite sectors in the U.S. and Britain that within their societies, coercion was a tool of diminishing utility, and that it would be necessary to devise new means to tame the beast, primarily through control of opinion and attitude. Huge industries have since developed devoted to these ends. Wilson's own view was that an elite of gentlemen with elevated ideals must be empowered to preserve stability and righteousness. Leading public intellectuals agreed. The public must be put in its place, Walter Lippmann declared in his progressive essays on democracy. That goal could be achieved in part through the manufacture of consent, a self-conscious art and regular organ of popular government. This revolution in the practice of democracy should enable a specialized class to manage the common interests that very largely elude public opinion entirely. In essence, the Leninist ideal. Lippmann had observed the revolution in the practice of democracy firsthand as a member of Wilson's Committee on Public Information, which was established to coordinate wartime propaganda and achieved great success in whipping the population into war fever. The responsible men who are the proper decision makers, Lippmann continued, must live free of the trampling and the roar of the bewildered herd. These ignorant and meddlesome outsiders are to be spectators, not participants. The herd does have another function, to trample periodically in support of one or another element of the leadership class in an election. Unstated is that the responsible men gain that status not by virtue of any special talent or knowledge, but by willing subordination to the systems of actual power and loyalty to their operative principles. Crucially, that basic decisions over social and economic life are to be kept within institutions with top-down authoritarian control, while the participation of the beast is to be limited to a diminished public arena. Just how diminished the public arena should be is a matter of debate. Neoliberal initiatives of the past 30 years have been designed to restrict it, leaving basic decision-making within largely unaccountable private tyrannies, linked closely to one another and to a few powerful states. Democracy can then survive, but in sharply reduced form. The Reagan-Bush sectors have taken an extreme position in this regard, but the policy spectrum is fairly narrow. Some argue that it scarcely exists at all, mocking the pundits who actually make a living contrasting the finer points of the sitcoms on NBC with those broadcast on CBS during election campaigns. Through tacit agreement, the two major parties approach the contest for the presidency as political kabuki in which the players know their roles and everyone sticks to the script, striking poses that cannot be taken seriously. If the public escapes its marginalization and passivity, we face a crisis of democracy that must be overcome, liberal intellectuals explain, in part through measures to discipline the institutions responsible for the indoctrination of the young, schools, universities, churches, and the like, and perhaps even through government control of the media, if self-censorship does not suffice. In taking these views, contemporary intellectuals are drawing on good constitutional sources. James Madison held that power must be delegated to the wealth of the nation, the more capable set of men, who understand that the role of government is to protect the minority of the opulent against the majority. Pre-capitalist in his worldview, Madison had faith that the enlightened statesman and benevolent philosopher who were to exercise power would discern the true interest of their country and guard the public interest against mischief of democratic majorities. The mischief would be avoided, Madison hoped, under the system of fragmentation he devised. In later years, he came to fear that severe problems would arise with the likely increase of those who will labor under all the hardships of life and secretly sigh for a more equal distribution of its benefits. A good deal of modern history reflects these conflicts over who will make decisions and how. Recognition that control of opinion is the foundation of government, from the most despotic to the most free, goes back at least to David Hume, but a qualification should be added. It is far more important in the free societies where obedience cannot be maintained by the lash. It is only natural that the modern institutions of thought control, frankly called propaganda, before the word became unfashionable because of totalitarian associations, should have originated in the most free societies. Britain pioneered with its Ministry of Information, which undertook to direct the thought of most of the world. Wilson followed soon after with his Committee on Public Information. Its propaganda successes inspired progressive democratic theorists and the modern public relations industry. Leading participants in the CPI, like Lippmann and Edward Bernays, quite explicitly drew from these achievements of thought control, which Bernays called the engineering of consent, the very essence of the democratic process. The term propaganda became an entry in the Encyclopedia Britannica in 1922 and in the Encyclopedia of Social Sciences a decade later, with Harold Laswell's scholarly endorsement of the new techniques for controlling the public mind. The methods of the pioneers were particularly significant, Randall Marlin writes in his History of Propaganda, because of their widespread imitation by Nazi Germany, South Africa, the Soviet Union, and the U.S. Pentagon, though the achievements of the PR industry dwarf them all. Problems of domestic control become particularly severe when the governing authorities carry out policies that are opposed by the general population. In those cases, the political leadership may be tempted to follow the path of the Reagan administration, which established an Office of Public Diplomacy to manufacture consent for its murderous policies in Central America. One high government official described its Operation Truth as a huge psychological operation of the kind the military conducts to influence a population in denied or enemy territory, a frank characterization of pervasive attitudes toward the domestic population. Enemy territory abroad. While the enemy at home often has to be controlled by intensive propaganda, beyond the borders, more direct means are available. The leaders of the current Bush administration, mostly recycled from more reactionary sectors of the Reagan-Bush-1 administrations, provided sufficiently clear illustrations during their earlier stints in office. When the traditional regime of violence and repression was challenged by the church and other miscreants in the Central American domains of U.S. power, the Reagan administration responded with a war on terror, declared as soon as they took office in 1981. Not surprisingly, the U.S. initiative instantly became a terrorist war, a campaign of slaughter, torture, and barbarism, which soon extended to other regions of the world as well. In one country, Nicaragua, Washington had lost control of the armed forces that had traditionally subdued the region's population, one of the bitter legacies of Wilsonian idealism. The U.S.-backed Somoza dictatorship was overthrown by the Sandinista rebels, and the murderous National Guard was dismantled. Therefore, Nicaragua had to be subjected to a campaign of international terrorism that left the country in ruins. Even the psychological effects of Washington's terrorist war are severe. The spirit of exuberance, vitality, and optimism that followed the overthrow of the dictatorship could not long survive as the reigning superpower intervened to dash the hopes that a grim history might finally take a different course. In the other Central American countries targeted by the Reaganite war on terror, forces equipped and trained by the United States maintained control. Without an army to defend the population against the terrorists, that is, the security forces themselves, atrocities were even worse. The record of murder, torture, and devastation was extensively reported by human rights organizations, church groups, Latin American scholars, and many others, but it remained little known to the citizens of the state that bore prime responsibility and was quickly effaced. By the mid-1980s, the U.S.-backed state terrorist campaigns had created societies affected by terror and panic, collective intimidation and generalized fear, in the words of a leading church-based Salvadoran human rights organization. The population had internalized acceptance of the daily and frequent use of violent means and the frequent appearance of tortured bodies. Returning from a brief visit to his native Guatemala, journalist Julio Godoy wrote that one is tempted to believe that some people in the White House worship Aztec gods with the offering of Central American blood. He had fled a year earlier when his newspaper, La Época, was blown up by state terrorists, an operation that aroused no interest in the United States. Attention was carefully focused on the misdeeds of the official enemy, real, no doubt, but hardly detectable given the scale of U.S.-backed state terror in the region. The White House, Godoy wrote, installed and supported forces in Central America that could easily compete against Nicolae Ceaușescu's Securitate for the World Cruelty Prize. After the terrorist commanders had achieved their goals, the consequences were reviewed at a conference in San Salvador of Jesuits and lay associates who had more than enough personal experience to draw on, quite apart from what they had observed through the grisly decade of the 1980s. The conference concluded that it does not suffice to focus on the terror alone. It is no less important to explore what weight the culture of terror has had in domesticating the expectations of the majority, preventing them from considering alternatives to the demands of the powerful, not only in Central America. Destroying hope is a critically important project, and when it is achieved, formal democracy is allowed, even preferred, if only for public relations purposes. In more honest circles, much of this is conceded. Of course, it is understood much more profoundly by the beasts in men's shapes who endure the consequences of challenging the imperatives of stability and order. These are all matters that the second superpower, world public opinion, should make every effort to understand, if it hopes to escape the containment to which it is subjected and to take seriously the ideals of justice and freedom that come easily to the lips, but are harder to defend and advance. Chapter 2. Imperial Grand Strategy. Enforcing Hegemony. High on the global agenda by fall 2002 was the declared intention of the most powerful state in history to maintain its hegemony through the threat or use of military force, the dimension of power in which it reigns supreme. In the official rhetoric of the National Security Strategy, our forces will be strong enough to dissuade potential adversaries from pursuing a military buildup in hopes of surpassing or equaling the power of the United States. One well-known international affairs specialist, John Eikenberry, describes the declaration as a grand strategy that begins with a fundamental commitment to maintaining a unipolar world in which the United States has no peer competitor, a condition that is to be permanent so that no state or coalition could ever challenge the U.S. as global leader, protector, and enforcer. The declared approach renders international norms of self-defense enshrined by Article 51 of the UN Charter almost meaningless. More generally, the doctrine dismisses international law and institutions as of little value. Eikenberry continues, "The new imperial grand strategy presents the United States as a revisionist state seeking to parlay its momentary advantages into a world order in which it runs the show, prompting others to find ways to work around, undermine, contain, and retaliate against U.S. power. The strategy threatens to leave the world more dangerous and divided, and the United States less secure," a view widely shared within the foreign policy elite. The imperial grand strategy asserts the right of the United States to undertake preventive war at will. Preventive, not preemptive. Preemptive war might fall within the framework of international law. Thus, if Russian bombers had been detected approaching the U.S. from the military base in Grenada, conjured up by the Reagan administration in 1983 with the clear intent to bomb, then, under a reasonable interpretation of the UN Charter, a preemptive attack destroying the planes and perhaps even the Grenadian base would have been justifiable. Cuba, Nicaragua, and many others could have exercised the same right for many years while under attack from the U.S., though of course the weak would have to be insane to implement their rights. But the justifications for a preemptive war, whatever they might be, do not hold for preventive war, particularly as that concept is interpreted by its current enthusiasts, the use of military force to eliminate an imagined or invented threat, so that even the term preventive is too charitable. Preventive war falls within the category of war crimes. If indeed it is an idea whose time has come, then the world is in deep trouble. As the invasion of Iraq began, the prominent historian and Kennedy advisor Arthur Schlesinger wrote that the president has adopted a policy of anticipatory self-defense that is alarmingly similar to the policy that Imperial Japan employed at Pearl Harbor, on a date which, as an earlier American president said it would, lives in infamy. Franklin D. Roosevelt was right, but today it is we Americans who live in infamy. He added that the global wave of sympathy that engulfed the United States after 9/11 has given way to a global wave of hatred of American arrogance and militarism. And even in friendly countries, the public regards Bush as a greater threat to peace than Saddam Hussein. International law specialist Richard Falk finds it inescapable that the Iraq War was a crime against peace of the sort for which surviving German leaders were indicted, prosecuted, and punished at the Nuremberg trials. Some defenders of the strategy recognize that it runs roughshod over international law, but see no problem in that. The whole framework of international law is just hot air, legal scholar Michael Glennon writes. The grand attempt to subject the rule of force to the rule of law should be deposited in the ashcan of history. A convenient stance for the one state able to adopt the new non-rules for its purposes, since it spends almost as much as the rest of the world combined on means of violence, and is forging new and dangerous paths in developing means of destruction over near unanimous world opposition. The proof that the system is all hot air is straightforward. Washington made it clear that it intends to do all it can to maintain its preeminence, then announced that it would ignore the UN Security Council over Iraq and declared more broadly that it would no longer be bound by the UN Charter's rules governing the use of force, QED. Accordingly, the rules have collapsed, and the entire edifice came crashing down. This, Glennon concludes, is a good thing, since the U.S. is the leader of the enlightened states and therefore must resist any effort to curb its use of force. The enlightened leader is also free to change the rules at will. When the military forces occupying Iraq failed to discover the weapons of mass destruction that allegedly justified the invasion, the administration's stance shifted from absolute certainty that Iraq possessed WMD on a scale that required immediate military action to the assertion that American accusations had been justified by the discovery of equipment that potentially could be used to produce weapons. Senior officials suggested a refinement in the controversial concept of a preventive war that entitles Washington to take military action against a country that has deadly weapons in mass quantities. The revision suggests instead that the administration will act against a hostile regime that has nothing more than the intent and ability to develop WMD. Virtually any country has the potential and ability to produce WMD, and intent is in the eye of the beholder. Hence, the refined version of the grand strategy effectively grants Washington the right of arbitrary aggression. Lowering the bar for the resort to force is the most significant consequence of the collapse of the proclaimed argument for the invasion. The goal of the imperial grand strategy is to prevent any challenge to the power, position, and prestige of the United States. The quoted words are not those of Dick Cheney or Donald Rumsfeld, or any of the other statist reactionaries who formulated the national security strategy of September 2002. Rather, they were spoken by the respected liberal elder statesman Dean Acheson in 1963. He was justifying U.S. actions against Cuba in full knowledge that Washington's international terrorist campaign aimed at regime change had been a significant factor in bringing the world close to nuclear war only a few months earlier, and that it was resumed immediately after the Cuban Missile Crisis was resolved. Nevertheless, he instructed the American Society of International Law that no legal issue arises when the U.S. responds to a challenge to its power, position, and prestige. Acheson's doctrine was subsequently invoked by the Reagan administration at the other end of the political spectrum when it rejected world court jurisdiction over its attack on Nicaragua, dismissed the court order to terminate its crimes, and then vetoed two Security Council resolutions affirming the court judgment and calling on all states to observe international law. State Department legal advisor Abraham Sofair explained that most of the world cannot be counted on to share our view, and that this same majority often opposes the United States on important international questions. Accordingly, we must reserve to ourselves the power to determine which matters fall essentially within the domestic jurisdiction of the United States. In this case, the actions that the court condemned as the unlawful use of force against Nicaragua. In lay terms, international terrorism. Contempt for international law and institutions was particularly flagrant in the Reagan-Bush years. The first reign of Washington's current incumbents and their successors continued to make it clear that the U.S. reserved the right to act unilaterally when necessary, including unilateral use of military power, to defend such vital interests as ensuring uninhibited access to key markets, energy supplies, and strategic resources. But the posture was not exactly new. The basic principles of the Imperial Grand Strategy of September 2002 go back to the early days of World War II. Even before the U.S. entered the war, high-level planners and analysts concluded that in the post-war world, the U.S. would seek to hold unquestioned power, acting to ensure the limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by states that might interfere with its global designs. They recognized further that the foremost requirement to secure these ends was the rapid fulfillment of a program of complete rearmament, then, as now, a central component of an integrated policy to achieve military and economic supremacy for the United States. At the time, these ambitions were limited to the non-German world, which was to be organized under the U.S. aegis as a grand area, including the Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, and the Far East. After it became fairly clear that Germany would be defeated, the plans were extended to include as much of Eurasia as possible. The precedents, barely sampled here, reveal the narrow range of the planning spectrum. Policy flows from an institutional framework of domestic power, which remains fairly stable. Economic decision-making power is highly centralized, and John Dewey scarcely exaggerated when he described politics as the shadow cast on society by big business. It is only natural that state policy should seek to construct a world system open to U.S. economic penetration and political control, tolerating no rivals or threats. A crucial corollary is vigilance to block any moves toward independent development that might become a virus infecting others, in the terminology of planners. That is a leading theme of post-war history, often disguised under thin Cold War pretexts that were also exploited by the superpower rival in its narrower domains. The basic missions of global management have endured from the early post-war period, among them, containing other centers of global power within the overall framework of order managed by the United States, maintaining control of the world's energy supplies, barring unacceptable forms of independent nationalism, and overcoming crises of democracy within domestic enemy territory. The missions assume different forms, notably in periods of fairly sharp transition, the changes in the international economic order from about 1970, the restoration of the superpower enemy to something like its traditional quasi-colonial status 20 years later, the threat of international terrorism aimed at the United States itself from the early 1990s, shockingly consummated on 9/11. Over the years, Tactics have been refined and modified to deal with these shifts, progressively ratcheting up the means of violence and driving our endangered species closer to the edge of catastrophe. Nevertheless, the September 2002 unveiling of the Imperial Grand Strategy justifiably sounded alarm bells. Acheson and Sofair were describing policy guidelines and within elite circles. Their stands are known only to specialists or readers of dissident literature. Other cases may be regarded as worldly wise reiterations of the maxim of Thucydides, that large nations do what they wish while small nations accept what they must. In contrast, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Powell, and their associates are officially declaring an even more extreme policy, one aimed at permanent global hegemony by reliance on force where necessary. They intend to be heard and took action at once to put the world on notice that they mean what they say. That is a significant difference. New norms of international law. The declaration of the Grand Strategy was rightly understood to be an ominous step in world affairs. It is not enough, however, for a great power to declare an official policy. It must go on to establish the policy as a new norm of international law by carrying out exemplary actions. Distinguished specialists and public intellectuals may then soberly explain that law is a flexible living instrument, so that the new norm is now available as a guide to action. Accordingly, as the new imperial strategy was announced, the war drums began to beat to rouse public enthusiasm for an attack on Iraq. At the same time, the midterm election campaign opened. The conjunction, already noted, should be kept in mind. The target of preventive war must have several characteristics. 1. It must be virtually defenseless. 2. It must be important enough to be worth the trouble. 3. There must be a way to portray it as the ultimate evil and an imminent threat to our survival. Iraq qualified on all counts. The first two conditions are obvious. The third is easy to establish. It is only necessary to repeat the impassioned orations of Bush, Blair, and their colleagues. The dictator is assembling the world's most dangerous weapons in order to dominate, intimidate, or attack. And he has already used them on whole villages, leaving thousands of his own citizens dead, blind, or transfigured. If this is not evil, then evil has no meaning. The president's eloquent denunciation in his January 2003 State of the Union address surely rings true. And certainly those who contribute to enhancing evil should not enjoy impunity. Among them, the speaker of those lofty words and his current associates, who long supported the man of ultimate evil in full awareness of his crimes. It is impressive to see how easy it is, while recounting the monster's worst offenses, to suppress the crucial words, "with our help," which continued because we didn't care. Praise and support shifted to denunciation as soon as the monster committed his first authentic crime, disobeying or perhaps misunderstanding orders by invading Kuwait in 1990. Punishment was severe for his subjects. The tyrant, however, escaped unscathed and was further strengthened by the sanctions regime then imposed by his former friends. As the time approached to demonstrate the new norm of preventive war in September 2002, National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice warned that the next evidence of Saddam Hussein's intentions might be a mushroom cloud, presumably in New York. Hussein's neighbors, including Israeli intelligence, dismissed the allegations, which were later undermined by the UN inspectors, though Washington continued to claim otherwise. From the first moments of the propaganda offensive, it was apparent that the pronouncements lacked credibility. This administration is capable of any lie in order to advance its war goal in Iraq, says a U.S. government source in Washington with some two decades of experience in intelligence. Washington opposed inspections, he suggested, because it feared that nothing much would be found. The president's claims about Iraqi threats should be viewed as transparent attempts to scare Americans into supporting a war, two leading international relations scholars added. That is standard operating procedure. Washington still refuses to provide evidence to support its 1990 claims of a huge Iraqi military buildup on the Saudi border, the primary justification offered for the 1991 war, claims instantly undermined by the one journal that investigated them, but to no effect. Evidence or not, the president and his associates issued grim warnings about the dire threat Saddam posed to the United States and to his neighbors, and his links to international terrorists, hinting broadly that he was involved in the 9/11 attacks. The government media propaganda assault had its effects. Within weeks, some 60% of Americans came to regard Saddam Hussein as an immediate threat to the U.S., who must be removed quickly in self-defense. By March,
almost half believed that Saddam Hussein was personally involved in the 9/11 attacks and that the hijackers included Iraqis. Support for the war was strongly correlated with these beliefs. Abroad, public diplomacy failed badly, the international press reported, but at home it has succeeded brilliantly in linking the war on Iraq with the trauma of September 11th. Nearly 90% believe Saddam's regime is aiding and abetting terrorists who are planning future strikes against the U.S. Political analyst Anatole Levin commented that most Americans had been duped by a propaganda program for which systematic mendacity has few parallels in peacetime democracies. The September 2002 propaganda campaign also proved sufficient to give the administration a bare majority in the midterm elections, as voters put aside their immediate concerns and huddled under the umbrella of power in fear of the demonic enemy. Public diplomacy worked its magic with Congress instantaneously. In October, Congress granted the president authority to go to war to defend the national security of the United States against the continuing threat posed by Iraq. This particular script is familiar. In 1985, President Reagan declared a national emergency, renewed annually, because the policies and the actions of the government of Nicaragua constitute an unusual and extraordinary threat to the national security and foreign policy of the United States. In 2002, Americans again had to tremble in fear, this time before Iraq. The brilliant success of public diplomacy at home was revealed once again when the president provided a powerful Reagan-esque finale to a six-week war on the deck of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln on May 1, 2003. He was free to declare, without concern for skeptical domestic comment, that he had won a victory in a war on terror by having removed an ally of Al-Qaeda. It is immaterial that the alleged link between Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden, in fact his bitter enemy, was based on no credible evidence and largely dismissed by competent observers. Also immaterial is the only known connection between the Iraq invasion and the threat of terror, that the invasion enhanced the threat, as had been widely predicted. It appears to have been a huge setback in the war on terror by sharply increasing Al-Qaeda recruitment. The propaganda impact persisted past the end of the war. After the failure of intense efforts to discover WMD, a third of the population believed that U.S. forces had found WMD, and more than 20% believed Iraq had used them during the war. These may simply be the reactions of people who are subject to fear of just about anything after many years of intense propaganda designed to tame the great beast by inducing panic. The phrase powerful Reagan-esque finale is presumably a reference to Reagan's proud announcement that the U.S. was standing tall after having overcome the terrible threat posed by Grenada. Astute commentators added that Bush's carefully staged USS Abraham Lincoln extravaganza marked the beginning of his 2004 re-election campaign, which the White House hopes will be built as much as possible around national security themes, a staple of the campaign being the removal of Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein. To further drive home the message, the official campaign opening was delayed until mid-September 2004, so that the Republican convention, meeting in New York, would be able to celebrate the wartime leader who alone can save Americans from a reenactment of 9/11, as he did in Iraq. The electoral campaign will focus on the battle of Iraq, not the war, Chief Republican political strategist Karl Rove explained. This is part of a far larger and longer war against terrorism that Rove sees clearly, perchance fortuitously, stretching well toward Election Day 2004, and surely beyond. By September 2002, then, all three necessary factors for establishing the new norm of international law were in place. Iraq was defenseless, extremely important, and an imminent threat to our very existence. There was always the possibility that things might go wrong, but it was unlikely, at least for the invaders. The disparity of force was so phenomenal that overwhelming victory was assured, and any humanitarian consequences could be blamed on Saddam Hussein. If unpleasant, they would not be investigated, and traces would disappear from view, at least if the past is any guide. Victors do not investigate their own crimes, so that little is known about them, a principle that brooks few exceptions. The death toll of the U.S. wars in Indochina, for example, is not known within a range of millions. The same principle underlay the war crimes trials after World War II. The operational definition of crimes of war and crimes against humanity was straightforward. Crimes qualified as crimes if they were carried out by the enemy, not by the Allies. Destruction of urban civilian concentrations, for example, was excluded. The principle has been applied in subsequent tribunals, but only to defeated enemies or others who can be safely despised. After the invasion of Iraq was declared a success, it was publicly recognized that one motive for the war had been to establish the imperial grand strategy as a new norm. Publication of the National Security Strategy was the signal that Iraq would be the first test, not the last, the New York Times reported. Iraq became the petri dish in which this experiment in preemptive policy grew. A high official added that, "We will not hesitate to act alone, if necessary, to exercise our right of self-defense by acting preemptively, now that the norm has been established." The exemplary nature of the whole exercise in Iraq is well recognized by the rest of the world, Harvard Middle East historian Roger Owen observed. Peoples and regimes will have to change the way they see the world, from a view based on the United Nations and international law to one based on an identification with Washington's agenda. They are being instructed by the display of force to put aside any serious considerations of national interest in favor of reflecting American goals. The need for a demonstration of strength to maintain credibility in the eyes of the world may have tipped the balance on the war with Iraq. In a review of planning, the Financial Times traced the decision to go to war to mid-December 2002, after Iraq's submission of its declaration on armaments to the UN. There was a feeling that the White House was being mocked, says one person who worked closely with the National Security Council, during those days after the declaration was delivered on December 8th. A tin pot dictator was mocking the president. It provoked a sense of anger inside the White House. After that point, there was no prospect of a diplomatic solution. What followed was just diplomatic theater for obfuscation while military forces were put in place. With the grand strategy not only officially declared, but also implemented, the new norm of preventive war takes its place in the canon. The U.S. may now find it possible to turn to harder cases. There are many tempting possibilities: Iran, Syria, the Andean region, and a number of others. The prospects depend in large part on whether the second superpower can be intimidated and contained. The modalities for establishing norms merit further reflection. Most important, only those with the guns and the faith have the authority to impose their demands on the world. A revealing example of the prerogatives of power is the widely hailed normative revolution that ended the millennium. After a few false starts, the 1990s became the decade of humanitarian intervention. The new right to intervene on humanitarian grounds was established by the courage and altruism of the U.S. and its allies, particularly in Kosovo and East Timor, the two jewels of the diadem. The Kosovo bombing in particular is understood by distinguished authorities to have established the norm of resort to force without Security Council authorization. A simple question arises. Why were the 1990s considered the decade of humanitarian intervention, but not the 1970s? Since World War II, there have been two major examples of resort to force that really did put an end to terrible crimes, in both cases arguably in self-defense. India's invasion of East Pakistan in 1971, ending a mass slaughter and other horrors, and Vietnam's invasion of Cambodia in December 1978, terminating Pol Pot's atrocities as they were picking up through 1978. Nothing remotely comparable took place under the Western Aegis in the 1990s. Accordingly, someone who does not understand the conventions might be pardoned for asking why the new norm was not recognized as such in the 1970s. The idea is unthinkable, and the reasons seem clear. The real examples of intervention that terminated huge atrocities were carried out by the wrong people. Still worse, in both cases, the U.S. was adamantly opposed to intervention and moved instantly to punish the offender, particularly Vietnam, by subjecting it to a U.S.-backed Chinese invasion, then even harsher sanctions than before, while the U.S. and U.K. offered direct support for the ousted Khmer Rouge. It follows that the 1970s cannot have been the decade of humanitarian intervention, and no new norms could have been established then. The essential insight was formulated by a unanimous vote of the International Court of Justice in one of its earliest rulings in 1949. The court can only regard the alleged right of intervention as the manifestation of a policy of force, such as has, in the past, given rise to most serious abuses and such as cannot, whatever be the defects in international organization, find a place in international law. From the nature of things, intervention would be reserved for the most powerful states, and might easily lead to perverting the administration of justice itself. While Western powers and intellectuals were admiring themselves for having established the new norm of humanitarian intervention in the late 1990s, the rest of the world also had some thoughts on the matter. It is illuminating to see how they reacted, say, to Tony Blair's repetition of the official reasons for the bombing of Serbia in 1999. Failure to bomb would have dealt a devastating blow to the credibility of NATO, and the world would have been less safe as a result of that. The objects of NATO's solicitude did not seem overly impressed by the need to safeguard the credibility of those who had been crushing them for centuries. Nelson Mandela, for example, condemned Blair for encouraging international chaos together with America by ignoring other nations and playing policemen of the world in their attacks on Iraq in 1998 and Serbia the next year. In the world's largest democracy, which, after independence, began to recover from the grim effects of centuries of British rule, the Clinton-Blair efforts to shore up NATO's credibility and make the world safe were also not appreciated, but official and press condemnations in India remained unheard. Even in Israel, the client state par excellence, the pretensions of Clinton-Blair and a host of domestic admirers were ridiculed by leading military and political analysts as a return to old-fashioned gunboat diplomacy under the familiar cloak of moralistic righteousness and as a danger to the world. Another source of information might have been the non-aligned movement, the governments of about 80% of the world's population at the time of their South Summit in April 2000. The meeting was the most important in their history, the first ever at the level of heads of state, who, in addition to issuing a detailed and sophisticated critical analysis of the neoliberal socioeconomic programs called globalization by Western ideologues, also firmly rejected the so-called right of humanitarian intervention. That stand was reiterated in the Summit of Non-Aligned Countries in Malaysia in February 2003 in the same words. Perhaps they had learned too much history, the hard way, to be comforted by exalted rhetoric and had heard enough about humanitarian intervention over the centuries. It is an exaggeration to say that only the most powerful are granted the authority to establish norms of appropriate behavior for themselves. The authority is sometimes delegated to reliable clients. Thus, Israel's crimes are permitted to establish norms. For example, its regular resort to targeted killings of suspects, called terrorist atrocities when carried out by the wrong hands. In May 2003, two leading Israeli civil rights attorneys provided a detailed list of all of the liquidations and all of the attempted assassinations that Israel's security forces carried out during the Al-Aqsa Intifada, from November 2000 through April 2003. Using official and semi-official records, they found that Israel carried out no less than 175 liquidation attempts, one attempt every 5 days, killing 235 people, of whom 156 were suspected of crimes. "It greatly pains us to say the following," the lawyers wrote, "but the consistent, widespread policy of targeted liquidations bounds on a crime against humanity." Their judgment is not quite accurate. Liquidation is a crime in the wrong hands, but it is a justified, if regrettable, act of self-defense when carried out by a client, and even establishes norms for the boss man called partner who provides authorization. The boss man himself made use of Israel's precedent with the assassination by missile of a suspect in Yemen, along with five other people who happened to be nearby, to much acclaim. The hit was conveniently timed as an October surprise to show the incumbent in his finest hour on the eve of the midterm elections, and offer a taste of what is to come. A more far-reaching example of establishing norms was Israel's bombing of the Oserak reactor in Iraq in June 1981. At first, the attack was criticized as a violation of international law. Later, after Saddam Hussein was transformed from favored friend to unspeakable fiend in August 1990, the reaction to the Oserak bombing also shifted. Once a minor crime, it was now considered an honored norm, and was greatly praised for having impeded Saddam Hussein's nuclear weapons program. The norm, however, required the evasion of a few inconvenient facts. Shortly after the 1981 bombing, the Oserak site was inspected by a prominent nuclear physicist, Richard Wilson, then chair of the physics department at Harvard University. He concluded that the installation bombed was not suited for plutonium production, as Israel had charged, unlike Israel's own Dimona reactor, which had reportedly produced several hundred nuclear weapons. His conclusions were supported by the Iraqi nuclear physicist Imad Kaduri, who was in charge of experimental work at the reactor before the bombing and later fled the country. He too reported that the Oserak reactor was unsuitable for the production of plutonium, though after the Israeli bombing in 1981, Iraq took the solid decision to go full speed ahead with weaponization. Kaduri estimated that it would have taken Iraq decades to obtain the required amount of weapons-grade material had the program not been sharply accelerated as a result of the bombing. Israel's action increased the determination of Arabs to produce nuclear weapons, Kenneth Waltz concluded. Israel's strike, far from foreclosing Iraq's nuclear career, gained Iraq support from some other Arab states to pursue it. Whatever the facts, thanks to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait a decade later, the norm that Israel established in 1981 is now firmly in place. And if indeed the 1981 bombing accelerated the proliferation of WMD, that in no way tarnishes the deed and teaches no lessons about the consequences of resort to force in violation of old-fashioned conceptions of international law, conceptions that must be discarded now that they have been demonstrated to be hot air by the boss man's contempt for them. In the future, the U.S. and its Israeli client, and perhaps some highly favored others, can resort to the norm as they see fit. The rule of law. The grand strategy extends to domestic U.S. law. As in many other countries, the government used the occasion of the terrorist atrocities of 9/11 to discipline its own population. After 9/11, often with questionable relation to terror, the Bush administration claimed and exercised the right to declare people, including U.S. citizens, to be enemy combatants or suspected terrorists, and to imprison them without charge or access to lawyers or family until the White House determines that its war on terror has been successfully concluded. That is, indefinitely. The Ashcroft Justice Department takes it to be fundamental that if you hold someone as an enemy combatant, obviously you hold them without access to family members and without access to counsel. These claims of executive authority have been partially upheld by the courts, which have ruled that a wartime president can indefinitely detain a United States citizen captured as an enemy combatant on the battlefield and deny that person access to a lawyer. The treatment of enemy combatants in Washington's Guantanamo prison camp, in a still-occupied part of Cuba, elicited substantial protest from human rights organizations and others. Even the Justice Department's own Inspector General, in a scathing report that the department disregarded. After the conquest of Iraq, evidence soon surfaced that Iraqi prisoners were being subjected to similar treatment, gagged, bound, hooded, beaten in the manner of the Afghans and other captives held at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Treatment in itself questionable under international law, to put it mildly. The Red Cross strongly protested the refusal of the U.S. command to allow it access to prisoners of war in violation of the Geneva Conventions and to captured civilians. Moreover, the designations are capricious. An enemy combatant can be anyone that the U.S. chooses to target, with no credible evidence, as Washington concedes. Justice Department thinking is illuminated by a confidential plan leaked to the Center for Public Integrity entitled Domestic Security Enhancement Act of 2003. This new assault on our civil liberties vastly expands state power, Yale law professor Jack Balkin writes. It undermines constitutional rights by granting the state the authority to rescind citizenship on the charge of providing material support to an organization on the Attorney General's blacklist, even if the accused has no idea that the organization has been blacklisted. Give a few dollars to a Muslim charity Ashcroft thinks is a terrorist organization, Balkin writes, and you could be on the next plane out of this country. The plan states that an intent to relinquish nationality need not be manifested in words, but can be inferred from conduct, inferred by the Attorney General, whose judgment we must honor on faith. Analogies have been drawn to the darkest days of McCarthyism, but these new proposals are more extreme. The plan also extends powers of surveillance without court authorization, permits secret arrests, and further protects the state from the scrutiny of citizens, a matter of great significance to the reactionary statists of the second Bush regime. There is no civil right, not even the precious right of citizenship, that this administration will not abuse to secure ever greater control over American life, Balkin concludes. President Bush is said to have on his desk a bust of Winston Churchill, a gift from his friend Tony Blair. Churchill had a few things to say on these topics. The power of the executive to cast a man into prison without formulating any charge known to the law, and particularly to deny him the judgment of his peers, is in the highest degree odious, and the foundation of all totalitarian government, whether Nazi or communist. The powers the Bush administration is demanding go well beyond even these odious practices. Churchill's warning against such abuse of executive power for intelligence and preventive purposes was issued in 1943, when Britain was facing possible destruction at the hands of the most vicious mass murder machine in human history. Perhaps someone in the Justice Department might want to contemplate the thoughts of the man whose image faces their leader every day. International law and institutions. The imperial grand strategy effectively dispenses with the international rule of law as an overarching goal of policy. A critical review by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences points out, noting that neither international law nor the UN Charter is even mentioned in the National Security Strategy. The primacy of law over force that has been a major threat in American foreign policy since the end of World War II disappears from the new strategy. Also, all but disappeared are the international institutions that extend the reach of law and seek to constrain the powerful as well as to grant the weak a voice. From now on, force reigns, and the U.S. will exercise that force as it sees fit. The analysts conclude that the strategy will increase the motivation of U.S. enemies to act in reaction to their growing resentment of perceived intimidation. They will seek cheap and easy ways of exploiting U.S. vulnerabilities, which abound. Lack of concern with this on the part of Bush planners is also illustrated by the fact that the National Security Strategy contains just a single sentence on enhancing arms control efforts, for which the administration has only contempt. Writing in the Academy's journal, two international affairs specialists describe the plans for extended confrontation, not political accommodation, as inherently provocative. They warn that the apparent commitment of the United States to active military confrontation for decisive national advantage carries immense risks. Many concur, even on narrow grounds of self-interest. The Academy's assessment of the primacy of law over force in American policy requires serious qualifications. Since World War II, the U.S. government has adopted the standard practice of powerful states, regularly choosing force over law when that was considered expedient for the national interest, a technical term referring to the special interests of domestic sectors that are in a position to determine policy. For the Anglo-American world, that truism is as old as Adam Smith. He bitterly condemned the merchants and manufacturers in England who were by far the principal architects of policy and made sure their own interests were most peculiarly attended to, no matter how grievous the effect on others, including the victims of their savage injustice abroad and the people of England as well. Truisms have a way of remaining true. The dominant elite view with regard to the UN was well expressed in 1992 by Francis Fukuyama, who had served in the Reagan-Bush State Department. The UN is perfectly serviceable as an instrument of American unilateralism, and indeed may be the primary mechanism through which that unilateralism will be exercised in the future. His prediction proved accurate, presumably because it was based on consistent practice going back to the early days of the UN. At that time, the state of the world guaranteed that the UN would be virtually an instrument of U.S. power. The institution was greatly admired, though elite distaste for it increased notably in subsequent years. The shift of attitude roughly traced the course of decolonization, which opened a small window for the tyranny of the majority, that is, for concerns emanating from outside the centers of concentrated power that the business press calls the de facto world government of the masters of the universe. When the UN fails to serve as an instrument of American unilateralism on issues of elite concern, it is dismissed. One of many illustrations is the record of vetoes. Since the 1960s, the U.S. has been far in the lead in vetoing Security Council resolutions on a wide range of issues, even those calling on states to observe international law. Britain is second, France and Russia far behind. Even that record is skewed by the fact that Washington's enormous power often compels the weakening of resolutions to which it objects, or keeps crucial matters off the agenda entirely. Washington's wars in Indonesia, to cite one example that was of more than a little concern to the world. Saddam Hussein was rightly condemned for his failure to comply fully with numerous Security Council resolutions, though less was said about the fact that the U.S. rejected the same resolutions. The most important of them, Resolution 687, called for ending sanctions when Iraqi compliance was determined by the Security Council and moving on to eliminate WMD and delivery systems from the Middle East, Article 14, a coded reference to Israel. There was never a possibility that the U.S. would accept Article 14, and it was removed from discussion. The first President Bush and his Secretary of State, James Baker, announced at once that the U.S. would reject the primary condition of 687 as well, barring even relaxation of sanctions as long as Saddam Hussein is in power. Clinton concurred. His Secretary of State, Warren Christopher, wrote in 1994 that Iraqi compliance is not enough to justify lifting the embargo, thus changing the rules unilaterally, Dilip Hero points out. Washington's use of UN inspectors, UNSCOM, to spy on Iraq also undermined inspections, which were terminated by Iraq after Clinton and Blair bombed the country in December 1998 in defiance of the UN. The likely outcome of these inspections is known with confidence only to ideologues on all sides. It was clear enough throughout, however, that disarmament through international inspectors was not the US-UK objective, and that the two warrior states would not comply with the relevant UN resolutions. Some commentators have pointed out that Israel has the lead in violating resolutions. US-backed Turkey and Morocco have also violated more Security Council resolutions than Iraq. These resolutions have to do with highly significant matters: aggression, harsh and brutal practices during decades-long military occupations, grave breaches of the Geneva Conventions, war crimes in terms of U.S. law, and other matters that rank higher than incomplete disarmament. The resolutions concerning Iraq also refer to internal repression, and in this respect, Saddam Hussein's record was horrendous. But that was, regrettably, only a side issue, as revealed by the support for him by the current incumbents in Washington well past his worst crimes and the war with Iran. Resolutions concerning Israel do not come under Chapter 7, which would carry the threat of force, but any proposal would instantly be vetoed by the U.S. The veto brings up another important matter missing from the discussions of Iraq's incomplete compliance with Security Council resolutions. Plainly, if Iraq had had the right to veto, it would have been in defiance of no UN resolutions. No less plainly, any serious discussion of defiance of the Security Council must take into account vetoes, the most extreme form of non-compliance. That exercise is excluded, however, because of the conclusions that would follow at once. The issue of the veto was not entirely ignored during the preparation for the Iraq invasion. France's threat to veto a UN declaration of war was bitterly condemned. "They said they are going to veto anything that held Saddam to account," Bush declared, with his familiar concern for truth, as he delivered his ultimatum to the Security Council on March 16, 2003. There was much fury about France's iniquity, and talk of actions to punish the country that did not follow orders from Crawford, Texas. In general, threat of veto by others is a scandal, revealing the failure of diplomacy and the miserable behavior of the UN. To select virtually at random, if lesser powers contrive to turn the Council into a forum for counterbalancing American power with votes, words, and public appeals, they will further erode its legitimacy and credibility, according to Edward Luck, director of the Center on International Organization at Columbia University. Routine resort to the veto by the world champion is generally ignored or downplayed, occasionally hailed as demonstrating the principled stand of embattled Washington. But there is no concern that this erodes the legitimacy or credibility of the UN. There should have been little reason for surprise, therefore, when a senior Bush administration official explained in October 2002 that "we don't need the Security Council, so if it wants to stay relevant, then it has to give us similar authority to that just granted by Congress, authority to use force at will." The stand was endorsed by the President and by Secretary of State Colin Powell, who added that, "obviously the Council can always go off and have other discussions, but we have the authority to do what we believe is necessary." Washington agreed to submit a resolution to the Security Council, UN 1441, leaving no doubt, however, that the exercise was meaningless. Whatever the diplomatic niceties, Mr. Bush made it clear that he regarded the resolution to be all the authority he needed to act against Iraq should Mr. Hussein balk, diplomatic correspondents observed. Though Washington would consult other members of the Security Council, it would not feel it necessary to win their approval. Echoing Powell, White House Chief of Staff Andrew Card explained that "the UN can meet and discuss, but we don't need their permission." The administration's decent respect for the opinion of mankind in declaring the causes which impel it to action was reemphasized when Powell addressed the Security Council a few months later, announcing Washington's intention to go to war. U.S. officials were adamant that his briefing should not be interpreted as part of a protracted effort to garner support for a resolution authorizing the use of force, the international press reported. A U.S. official said, "We're not going to negotiate on a second resolution because we don't need to. If the rest of the Council wants to catch up to us, we might stop briefly to sign on the dotted line, but nothing more." The world was placed on notice that Washington will use force as it chooses. The debating society can catch up and join the enterprise or suffer the consequences that befall those who are not with us and are therefore with the terrorists, as the President laid out the options. Bush and Blair underscored their contempt for international law and institutions at their subsequent summit meeting at a U.S. military base in the Azores, where they were joined by Spain's Prime Minister, José María Aznar. The U.S.-UK leaders issued an ultimatum to the United Nations Security Council: "Capitulate in 24 hours, or we will invade Iraq and impose the regime of our choice without your meaningless seal of approval, and we will do so, crucially, whether or not Saddam Hussein and his family leave the country." "Our invasion is legitimate," Bush declared, "because the United States of America has the sovereign authority to use force in assuring its own national security. threatened by Iraq with or without Saddam. The UN is irrelevant because it has not lived up to its responsibilities, that is, to follow Washington's orders. The US will enforce the just demands of the world, even if the world overwhelmingly objects. Washington also took pains to ensure that the essential hollowness of official declarations was in plain view, for all the world to see. At a news conference on March 6, the president stated that there is only a single question: has the Iraqi regime fully and unconditionally disarmed as required by 1441, or has it not? He then immediately went on to make it clear that the answer to the single question did not matter, announcing that, when it comes to our security, we really don't need anyone's permission. UN inspections and Security Council deliberations were therefore a farce, and even completely verified compliance was irrelevant. A few days earlier, Bush had declared the answer to the single question immaterial. The U.S. will institute the regime of its choice even if Saddam disarms completely, and even if he and his cohorts disappear, as underscored at the Azores summit. The president's disregard of the single question was in fact already on record. A few months earlier, White House spokesman Ari Fleischer had informed the press that the policy of the United States is regime change, with or without inspectors. Regime change does not mean a regime that Iraqis might prefer, but one that the conqueror will impose, calling it democratic, which is standard practice. Even Russia installed people's democracies. Later, with the war winding down, Fleischer restored the single question to its primary status. Iraq's possession of WMD is what this war was about and is about. As Bush was presenting his self-contradictory stance at his news conference, British Foreign Minister Jack Straw announced that if Saddam Hussein disarmed, we accept that the government of Iraq stays in place, so that the single question is disarmament. Talk about liberation and democracy is mere fluff, and Britain will not support Bush's resort to war on his grounds, except that Britain made it clear that it would do as it was told. Meanwhile, Colin Powell contradicted the president's declaration that the U.S. will take control of Iraq no matter what. The question simply is, has Saddam Hussein made a strategic political decision to comply with the United Nations Security Council resolutions and to get rid of his weapons of mass destruction? That's it in a nutshell. That's the question. There is no other question. Back to the single question rejected by the president 5 days earlier and again the following day. As the invasion began, Powell returned to the single question. Iraq was being attacked because it had violated its international obligations under its 1991 surrender agreement, which required the disclosure and disarmament of its dangerous weapons. Everything else that has been claimed is therefore irrelevant. The U.S. will unilaterally decide that the inspectors should not be permitted to do their work, and the 1991 agreement entitles the U.S. to resort to violence contrary to its explicit wording. Pick some other day and audience, and the goal is liberation and democracy, not only for Iraq but for the region, a noble dream. The message is clear. We will do what we choose, giving whatever pretext happens to be on hand. You will catch up or else. Unexplained is why the threat of WMD became so severe after September 2002, while before National Security Advisor Rice had accepted the consensus that if they do acquire WMD, their weapons will be unusable because any attempt to use them will bring national obliteration. Punishment for being against us can be severe, and the benefits of catching up and remaining relevant are substantial. Senior U.S. officials were dispatched to Security Council members to urge leaders to vote with the United States on Iraq or risk paying a heavy price. Not an insignificant concern for fragile countries, whose concerns drew little attention before they landed seats on the council. Mexican diplomats tried to explain to Washington's emissaries that the people are overwhelmingly opposed to a war, but that plea was dismissed as ridiculous. A special problem arose for countries that have succumbed to popular pressure to embrace democracy and now have a public to answer to. For them, repercussions for taking democratic forms seriously may include economic strangulation. In contrast, Mr. Powell made clear that U.S. political and military allies will benefit from handouts. Ari Fleischer, meanwhile, hotly denied that Bush was offering quid pro quos in exchange for votes, evoking peals of laughter from the press corps, the Wall Street Journal reported. Rewards for following orders include not only financial handouts, but also authorization to escalate terrorist atrocities. Russian President Vladimir Putin, whose relations with Bush are reported to be particularly soulful, was awarded a diplomatic nod for Russia's crackdown on Chechen separatists, a move that some analysts here and in the Middle East contend could damage long-term U.S. interests. One might imagine some other reasons to be concerned about Washington's support for state terrorism. To make it clear that such reactions are irrelevant, the head of a Muslim charity was sentenced in federal court on the charge of having diverted funds to Chechens resisting the vicious Russian military occupation, just as Putin was receiving his green light. The head of the same charity was also charged with funding ambulances for Bosnia. In that case, the crime was apparently committed at about the same time that Clinton was flying al-Qaeda and Hezbollah operatives to Bosnia to support the U.S. side in the ongoing wars. Turkey was offered similar inducements, a huge financial package, and the right to invade Kurdish northern Iraq. Remarkably, Turkey did not fully submit, teaching a lesson in democracy to the West that aroused great ire and, as Secretary of State Powell sternly announced at once, instant punishment for the misdeed. The diplomatic niceties are for those who prefer to be deluded, as is the apparent support of Security Council members for the U.S.-initiated Resolution 1441. The support is, in fact, submission. Signers understood what the alternative would be. In systems of law that are intended to be taken seriously, coerced acquiescence is invalid. In international affairs, however, it is honored as diplomacy. After the Iraq War, the UN again proved irrelevant because its complicated trade system for Iraq caused problems for U.S. companies granted contracts under U.S. military rule. The complicated trade system was in fact imposed by the U.S. as part of its sanctions regime, for which there was virtually no support outside the U.K. But now it was in the way. Hence, in the words of a coalition diplomat, the U.S. wanted the message to be, "We're coming here to the Security Council because we want to, not because we have to." The background issue, diplomats on all sides agree, is how much of a free hand the U.S. should be given to manage Iraqi oil and establish a successor government. Washington demands a free hand. Other countries, a large majority of the U.S. population, and to the extent that we have information, the people of Iraq, prefer to extend U.N. oversight there and to normalize Iraq's diplomatic and economic relations, as well as its internal affairs, within that framework. Through all the shifts and justifications and pretexts, one principle remains invariant. The U.S. must end up in effective control of Iraq under some facade of democracy if that proves feasible. That America's imperial ambition should extend to the whole world after the collapse of its sole major rival should hardly elicit surprise. And there are, needless to say, numerous predecessors, with consequences not too pleasant to recall. The current situation, however, is different. There has never in history been anything remotely like the near monopoly of means of large-scale violence in the hands of one state. All the more reason for subjecting its practices and operative doctrines to extra careful scrutiny. Elite concerns. Within establishment circles, there has been considerable concern that America's imperial ambition is a serious threat even to its own population. Their alarm reached new heights as the Bush administration declared itself to be a revisionist state that intends to rule the world permanently, becoming, some felt, a menace to itself and to mankind, under the leadership of radical nationalists aiming for unilateral world domination through absolute military superiority. Many others within the mainstream spectrum have been appalled by the adventurism and arrogance of the radical nationalists who have regained the power they wielded through the 1980s, but now operate with fewer external constraints. The concerns are not entirely new. During the Clinton years, the prominent political analyst Samuel Huntington observed that for much of the world, the U.S. is becoming the rogue superpower, considered the greatest external threat to their societies. Robert Jervis, then president of the American Political Science Association, warned that, in the eyes of much of the world, in fact, the prime rogue state today is the United States. Like others, they anticipated that coalitions might arise to counterbalance the rogue superpower, with threatening implications. Several leading figures of the foreign policy elite have pointed out that the potential targets of America's imperial ambition are not likely simply to await destruction. They know that the United States can be held at bay only by deterrence, Kenneth Waltz has written, and that weapons of mass destruction are the only means to deter the United States. Washington's policies are therefore leading to proliferation of WMD, Waltz concludes, tendencies accelerated by its commitment to dismantle international mechanisms to control the resort to violence. These warnings were reiterated as Bush prepared to attack Iraq. One consequence, according to Stephen Miller, is that others are likely to draw the conclusion that weapons of mass destruction are necessary to deter American intervention.